What we've all feared, your insurance rates could go up with car data collection. Apple allowing more mixed things in the EU, lots of great open source news and more. Welcome to Surveillance Report 171, where we're dedicated to keeping you private and secure with the latest news in the past week. I'm Henry from TechLore.
I'm Nathan from The New Oil.
And as always, just really quick, we couldn't be doing this without people on Patreon, and Patreon's been going through a lot of changes recently in terms of how we deliver it to all of you people on Patreon. So if you've seen that, you've seen that. If you haven't, definitely check it out, because it definitely makes things even more seamless for our people on Patreon. So if you want to get access to VIP episodes, which don't have these promo segments, and also join our Q&A, join our Patreon. If you don't like Patreon, we're also in LibrePay. We also accept Monero tips. And so those are three different ways that you can support this podcast and keep it going for free as long as we can. Highlight story. So automakers are sharing consumers' driving behavior with insurance companies. So Ken Dahl says he's always been a careful driver and the owner of a software company near Seattle. He drives a leased Chevy Bolt. He's never been responsible for an accident. So Mr. Dahl, 65, was surprised in 2022 when the cost of his car insurance jumped by 21%. Which, I mean, like, I'm used to being a younger person, my car insurance changing by 21%, but if I was 65 and my insurance changed 21%, I'd be very alarmed. Quotes from other insurance companies were also high, and one insurance agent told him LexisNexis, which is a company we've talked about here before, was a factor. Upon Mr. Dahl's request, LexisNexis sent him a 258-page consumer disclosure report, which it must provide per the Fair Credit Reporting Act. What it contained stunned him, because it had more than 130 pages detailing each time he or his wife had driven the Bolt over the previous 6 months. It included the dates of 640 trips, their start and end times, the distance driven, and an accounting of any speed, hard braking, or sharp accelerations. The only thing it didn't have is where they had driven the car. On a Thursday morning in June, for example, the car had been driven 7.33 miles in 18 minutes. There had been two rapid accelerations and two incidents of hard braking. According to the report, the trip details had been provided by General Motors, the manufacturer of the Chevy Bolt. LexisNexis analyzed that driving data to create a risk score for insurers to use as one factor of many to create more personalized insurance coverage. So eight insurance companies had requested information about Mr. Dahl from LexisNexis over the previous month. Sometimes this is happening with the driver's awareness and consent. So car companies have established relationships with insurance companies so that if drivers want to sign up for what's called usage-based insurance, where rates are set based on monitoring of their driving habits, then it's easy to collect that data wirelessly from their cars. And just adding in my own little thing here, Tesla even does this through their Tesla insurance. You can go on Tesla's website and it shows their Tesla insurance is like personalized to your driving habits. And then it says here, though, on the other hand, in other instances, like Mr. Dahl, something much sneakier has happened, which is modern cars are internet-enabled, allowing access to services like navigation, roadside assistance, and car apps that drivers can connect to their vehicles to locate them or unlock them remotely. In recent years, automakers including GM, Honda, Kia, and Hyundai have started offering optional features in their connected app. In their connected car apps that rate people's driving. Some drivers may not realize it, which is really the core issue here. And if they turn on those features, the car companies that give information about how they drive to data brokers, like LexisNexis. So they've partnered to collect detailed driving data from millions of Americans, and they say that they have driver's permission to do so, but the existence of these partnerships is nearly invisible to drivers whose consent is obtained in fine print and murky privacy policies that very few people read. You can't expect to just get a car and read the privacy policy. So what's especially troubling is some drivers with vehicles made by GM say they were tracked even when they did not turn on the feature, which is called OnStar Smart Driver, and that their insurance rates went up as a result. So the author of the article said, even for those who opt in, the risks are far from clear. And they said here, I have a GM car, a Chevrolet. I went through the enrollment process for Smart Driver, and there was no warning or prominent disclosure that any third party could get access to my driving data. Now, here's kind of the actual story here. That's the most recent story, which is a Cadillac driver, well, a different one, a Cadillac driver in Palm Beach City, Florida, who asked not to be named because he is considering a lawsuit against GM, said he was denied auto insurance by seven companies in December. When he asked an agent why, she advised him to pull his LexisNexis report. He discovered 6 months of his driving activity, including many instances of hard braking and hard accelerating, as well as some speeding. And he said, I don't know the definition of hard brake. My passenger's head isn't hitting the dash, he said. Same with acceleration. aggression. I'm not peeling out. I'm not sure how the car defines that. I don't feel I'm driving aggressively or dangerously. When he finally obtained car insurance through a private broker, it was double what he had previously been paying. In response to questions from the New York Times, GM confirmed that it shares select insights about hard braking, hard accelerating, speeding over 80 miles an hour, and drive time as smart driver enrollees with LexisNexis and another data broker that works with the insurance industry called Verisk. It is kind of interesting here because it says that it's possible that GM drivers who insisted they didn't opt in were unknowingly signed up at the dealership, where salespeople can receive bonuses for successful enrollment of customers in OnStar services, including things like Smart Driver, which is really crazy to think about. So the Cadillac owner in Florida said he had not heard of Smart Driver and never noticed it in the My Cadillac app. He reviewed the paperwork he signed at the dealership when he bought his Cadillac in the fall of 2021 and found no mention of signing up for it. Some drivers who had Smart Driver turned on, though, said they did not even realize they were enrolled until they saw warnings on online forums and then checked their app. They quickly unenrolled themselves by turning off Smart Driver in their car app. And the final little bullet point here before we get into it and give our thoughts, General Motors is not the only automaker sharing driving behavior. Kia, Subaru, and Mitsubishi also contribute to the LexisNexis Telematics Exchange, a portal for sharing consumer-approved connected car data with insurers. As of 2022, the exchange, according to a LexisNexis news release, had real-world driving behavior collected from over 10 million vehicles. Verisk also claims to have access to data for millions of vehicles and partnerships with major automakers, including Ford, Honda, and Hyundai. Big wow. This takes me back to the Mozilla. So Mozilla does privacy reports, and they did one on cars, and I think they deemed the whole category to be the most privacy invasive category they've ever reviewed, because there simply just wasn't even a not privacy invasive option nowadays. And this is one of the reasons why. And I think this really hits home for people. So this is a good story to share with people, because one thing is like, oh, hey, they're collecting your data, people. But another one is, oh, hey, this person's insurance actually shot up 26% because of some random feature that was never actually opted into. And it's based on like their driving habits that they never even consented to give over. So this is a really big story. Definitely think about this. The most obvious thing to share your way is go through your car settings, go through your mobile apps if you have a mobile app for your car, if that exists for you, and just make sure you opt out of any of this, because clearly we saw here some people didn't even sign up for it, and it was probably signed up for them on behalf of someone else because they wanted to get commission on enrolling them in this service. So really pay attention to this. Apparently LexisNexis scores are turning into the next credit card score for us Americans, which is awesome. I'm really excited for those times.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I don't have much to add. I do have one quick update that I think just came into my newsfeed like yesterday. That guy they mentioned that said, don't name me because I'm thinking about suing. Yeah, he is suing them. I went ahead and threw that in the show notes. The headline, it's still New York Times. It says Florida man sues GM and LexisNexis over sale of his Cadillac data. So you guys can read that if you want, but just a quick update. Also, the one thing I have to add is vehicleprivacyreport.com, which is powered by Privacy for Cars, which has been on Firewalls No Stop Dragons after that whole Mozilla report came out. You can go there, you can put in your VIN, your vehicle identification number, and they will tell you if they know that your car is collecting data and how you can opt out of it. All right, it's time for data breaches. We only have a few this week. Well, yeah, we have a few. First one's pretty quick. French unemployment agency data breach impacts 43 million people. So short, but not good. The data includes full name, date of birth, place of birth, social security number, which I guess is known as NIR in France, France travail identifier, whatever that is, email address, postal address, and phone number. So very unfortunate. If you are a French citizen or know someone who's French, I guess see if you're impacted. And I'm assuming France has some equivalent to a credit freeze, because most countries seem to. Maybe look into that. My categories.
Next one is from Nissan, who's confirmed a ransomware attack which exposed data of 100,000 people. This is from the Akura ransomware gang, which took responsibility for the attack and claimed it had stolen 100 gigabytes of data. This included documents containing personal employee information, NDAs, project data, and information on partners and clients. And Nissan has come forward and admitted that this happened. And it also happened to customers of Nissan, Mitsubishi, Renault, Skyline, Infiniti, LDV, and Ram dealerships in the region. Up to 10% of these individuals had government identification compromised, including Medicare cards, driver's licenses, passports, and tax file numbers. So there's some more stats in the article if you want to get more into this, if you think you're impacted. To support impacted customers, Nissan provides free access to ID Care, which is a free credit monitoring service through Equifax in Australia and Centrix and New Zealand, and reimbursement for the replacement of compromised government IDs. The automaker also advises customers to remain vigilant for suspicious activity on their accounts and to report it to the authorities, enable multi-factor authentication where possible, and update passwords regularly. Thanks, Nissan.
Our next data breach comes from Stanford, the university, where it says 27,000 people had their data stolen in September in a ransomware attack. The information that may have been affected varies from person to person, but it could include date of birth, social security number, government ID, passport number, driver's license number, and other information the Department of Public Safety may have collected in its operations. For a small number of individuals, this may have also included biometric data, health or medical information, email address with password, username with password. They didn't specify if it was hashed or not. I'm sure hoping so. Security questions and answers, digital signage, and credit card information with security codes. So regarding security questions and answers, make sure that you guys don't answer them honestly, because a lot of that stuff is stuff that can be looked up online. Like, where did you go to school? What was your father's middle name? Stuff like that. So instead, what I do is I make up an answer from like my passphrase generator, and then I save that in the note section of my password manager. And that kind of goes back to the argument of like, well, what if your password manager gets breached? It's far more likely that this is going to get breached instead, or that somebody is going to try and like guess those answers, in my opinion. Like, that's certainly a legitimate question. You could store them in a separate vault or a separate document. But the point being, I wouldn't use the default answers because they're too easy to look up.
Acer confirms Philippines employee data leaked on a hacking forum and that the no ransomware encryption was involved and that it was a pure data theft hack. They did provide evidence that they wiped data on the breach server before they lost access, and they reached out to Acer to verify the authenticity of the threat actor's claims, and they confirmed the data is theirs but was not acquired directly from the company's system. There was no elaboration on what was stolen or how many people were impacted, but notably in a screenshot, the criminal was using Proton Drive.
And our last story, we have no actual information on, but the headline says Equilend warns employees their data was stolen by a ransomware gang. Again, that's literally all we have. We don't have how many were affected, what data was stolen, just the usual quote, no indication the data is being abused at this time, and free credit monitoring. So if you are an Equilend employee, big yikes. Demand answers. That's all I got.
All right, companies. And we're going to start with Apple, and the saga continues in the EU. They are now going to allow iOS app downloads direct from websites in the EU. Definitely stay in a loop, though, because it gets interesting. So this is a new web distribution feature, which is available with a software update later this spring, providing developers with a key new way to distribute iOS apps in EU markets without the need for a separate app store, as long as they're willing to adhere to Apple's strict rules. To install apps from a developer's website, users will first need to approve the developer to install apps in settings on their iPhone, which sounds like what you kind of see on macOS. When installing an app, a system sheet will display information that developers have submitted to Apple for review, like the app name, developer name, app description, screenshots, and system age rating. They'll also need to agree to a number of key undertakings, though, as outlined by Apple. First, they need to be enrolled in the Apple Developer Program as an organization incorporated, domiciled, or registered in the EU, or have a subsidiary legal entity that's in the EU. So, already, you have to be in the EU to post something there. You have to be a member of good standing in the Apple Developer Program for 2 years or more, and have an app that has more than 1 million first annual installs in iOS in the EU in the prior calendar year. You can only offer apps from your developer account. And you have to be responsive to communications from Apple regarding your apps distributed through web distribution, particularly regarding any fraudulent, malicious, or illegal behavior, or anything else that Apple believes impacts the safety, security, or privacy of users. Publish transparent data collection policies and offer users control over how their data is collected and used. Follow applicable laws of the jurisdictions where you operate and be responsible for handling governmental and other requests to take listings down of apps. Apple currently allows developers to distribute their apps on third-party marketplaces in EU countries, but if those apps reach more than 1 million annual installs per year, they'll need to pay that 50 euro cent fee for every additional installation and update. That same core technology fee process is part of web distribution of iOS apps too. So I find it interesting that you have to have an app that had more than 1 million first annual installs on iOS, And similar, and if you flip that, the requirement, if you were to go on a third-party app store, is once you hit 1 million installs, you're charged 50 cents per year. I don't think people are taking this well, and I think there are lots of developers speaking up about this right now. So
we'll hop over to the Android side now, where Android 15 will let you find your Pixel 8 even when it's off. So the Find My Device network relies on Android devices broadcasting what are essentially Bluetooth beacons. Other nearby Android devices are part of the Find My Device network and are in range of the broadcasting device can pick up on the beacon. The receiving devices then encrypt the location of the Android device that's broadcasting and upload it to Google's server so that only the owner of the broadcasting device or the people they've shared their encryption key with can decrypt the location. So that's good. There's a little bit of privacy built in there. Powered off finding isn't the kind of feature that can be enabled on just any device. This is because the device needs to have hardware support for powering the Bluetooth controller when the rest of the components are shut down. Plus, device makers need to put in some extra engineering work to support this feature. For example, they need to support the Bluetooth Finder Hardware Abstraction Layer, or HAL, that's a great name, so that the Android OS can enable powered off finding mode and send those pre-computed Bluetooth beacons. Furthermore, where'd I go? There I am. Furthermore, device makers will need to update their devices to Google's upcoming Android 15 release, which will be the first release that actually includes the new powered off finding system APIs that send instructions to HAL to toggle the feature and or set the Bluetooth beacons. Although these APIs will be contained within the project mainline module called Tethering, they can only be used on devices that are running Android Vanilla Ice Cream, which is Android 15's internal dessert name. The powered off API will be utilized by the Google Play Services app, which means that we'll also have to wait for Google to roll out support in Play Services. Google has been working on adding powered off finding support to Play Services since last year, and the company has also been working on adding UI support directly to Android. So basically, they're working on bringing the actual toggle to your settings. It seems that at least some of Google's existing Pixel phones will support this feature. If the system property ro.bluetooth.finder.supported returns true, then it means the device supports powered off finding. This is the case for the Pixel 8 and 8 Pro, but not for any older Pixel devices such as the Fold, the 7 Pro, or the 6a, which I believe this comes from 9to5 Google. So this this author was actually disappointed that the Fold is not included and hopes it will be. So the good news is, quoting, here's the last quote, "The powered off finding feature will likely be announced during the launch of the upcoming Google Pixel 9 later this year, assuming, of course, that the Find My Device network goes live before then. Given that the 8 and 8 Pro support powered off finding, it's highly likely that the 8a, 9, and 9 Pro will as well. Once the feature launches, enabling it should be simple. Users will just need to have Bluetooth, location services, and either of the with network options enabled in Find My Device network settings." And then they have screenshots of all those. So it sounds like this will probably be an opt-in feature. At very least, for now, this should be a feature that you can turn off. Yeah, and again, if you have a lower model device, like anything older than an 8 and an 8 Pro, it just won't be supported at all in the first place. So, yeah. And then, of course, if you're running a custom OS, I'm sure they will add in the option to turn this off because they tend to be privacy focused, and why would they not? That is a thing. Just be aware of that with upcoming Android 15, especially if you're on a newer device, and make sure to opt out of that if it makes you uncomfortable. Although it is surprising and welcome to see that Google has some built-in privacy protections. Well, not to be redundant, but already built into this feature.
All right, I'm going to simplify this a little bit. Essentially, Brave has come forward and started speaking about, I saw this actually on Twitter myself before we started putting it in the show notes, but they pretty much have a little chart here. So with the iOS DMA stuff, they're required to essentially introduce other third-party browsers as a option. And Brave showed exactly what happened when that option was presented to EU users, and they got a huge increase in daily downloads in their browser. And pretty much it just shows that, yeah, when people are given other options to switch to a different default browser, look what happens. And so there's a huge increase in installations, and monopoly defenders argue that the monopolies simply offer better products. But as you can see, when consumers get a clear choice of iOS browsers, they're choosing alternatives to Safari, noted in their Twitter thread. And they also said maybe that's why Google still hasn't implemented a browser choice screen on Android. Firefox saw an increase in users following Apple's default browser change in the EU. And so Firefox saw a 50% jump in Germany and a 30% jump in France. So when we see all these browser stats and other browsers are falling while some are getting larger, there could be other factors involved that have to do with monopolies, possibly. I don't know.
That'll take us into research. We just have one story this week. Attackers can read private AI assistant chats even though they're encrypted. But basically, they talk about how people can ask potentially very sensitive questions to these AI assistants, like ChatGPT, for example. They could ask, advice about a divorce or, reproductive health, things like that. And for the record, especially those of you who are very critical of this technology will say, well, why would you do that? These things are so unreliable anyways, which is true, but they can be a good starting point. Like at least get me pointed in the right direction, especially if you don't even know what questions to ask. From there, quoting the article, the providers of these AI powered chat services are keenly aware of the sensitivity of these discussions and take active steps, mainly in the form of encrypting them to prevent potential snoops from reading other people's interactions. But now researchers have devised an attack that deciphers AI assistant responses with surprising accuracy. The technique exploits a side channel present in all of the major AI assistants, with the exception of Google Gemini. It then refines the fairly raw results through a large language model specifically trained for the task. So that's kind of ironic, using AI to crack AI. The result, someone with a passive adversary in the middle position can infer the specific topic of 55% of all captured responses, usually with high word accuracy. The attack can deduce responses with perfect word accuracy 29% of the time. Which, quick note, may not sound like much until you think like, okay, that sensitive question somebody just asked, flip a coin, and if it's heads, they have to tell the whole world. Like, I think when you put it like that, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, I don't know if I'd be comfortable with those odds. This includes malicious actors on the same Wi-Fi or LAN as a client, or even a malicious actor on the wider internet, anyone who can observe the traffic. The attack is passive and can happen without OpenAI or their client's knowledge. The researchers have made two proposals to mitigate the effectiveness of the attack. The first is to follow Google's example and stop sending packets one at a time, which is the part that I was like, that's weird. The other is to apply padding, a technique that adds random amounts of spaces to packets so that they all have a fixed length equal to the largest possible packet. Of all the chatbots that were vulnerable to the attack, those from OpenAI and Cloudflare have implemented padding mitigations in the past 48 hours at the time that the article was published.
And with that, we're going to head into politics, and we're going to start with the feds who are coming for extremist gamers. Raise your hand if you're an extremist gamer. Well, let's get into what that means. So the report reveals that DHS Intelligence Office meets with gaming companies and that the companies can use these meetings to share information with them about online activities promoting domestic violent extremism, or even simply activities that violate the company's terms of service. Through its 56 field offices and hundreds of resident agencies' subordinate field offices, the FBI receives tips from gaming companies of potential law-breaking and extremist views for further investigation. The FBI also conducts briefings to gaming companies on purported threats. The GAO warns that FBI and DHS lacks an overarching strategy to bring its work with gaming companies in line with broader agency missions. The report ends with a recommendation that both agencies develop such a strategy, a recommendation that DHS concurred with, providing an estimated completion date of June 28th this year. The government also recognizes that there are constitutional and legal questions about Americans' free speech rights. According to the GAO report, both the FBI and DHS indicated that they are proceeding with caution in light of federal litigation on such matters, including one case on its way to the Supreme Court. Federal law enforcement and intelligence have long focused on gaming as an avenue of both radicalization and as a backdoor platform for extremists to communicate. A 2019 internal intelligence assessment jointly produced by the FBI, DHS, and Joint Special Operations Command and the National Counterterrorism Center and obtained by The Intercept warns that violent extremists could exploit functionality of popular online gaming platforms and applications. The assessment lists half a dozen U.S.-owned gaming platforms that it identifies as popular, including Blizzard Entertainment's Battle.net, Fortnite, PlayStation, Xbox Live, Steam, and Roblox. How much of an issue is this? I'm not a gamer, but for people who are gamers, where is this coming from? I'm genuinely asking. I just don't even know. Is this a common thing?
Our last political story comes from Canada. It says, online harms bill and assault on free speech, civil liberty groups say. So the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, or CCLA, and the Canadian Constitution Foundation, CCF, say that while the proposed legislation contains legitimate measures to protect children from online sexual abuse, cyberbullying, and self-harm, and to combat the spread of so-called revenge porn, its provisions prevent the expression of hate. Its provision to prevent the expression of hate are draconian, vaguely worded, and an attack on free speech. So just like every other child protection bill in the world. This is what's known as Bill C-63, for those who are in Canada and want to know more. Both the CCLA and CCF warned the bill could lead to life imprisonment for someone convicted of, quote, the incitement of genocide, which sounds fair until you realize it's a vague term only broadly defined in the bill, and up to 5 years in prison for other vaguely defined hate speech crimes. The legislation, for example, defines illegal hate speech as expressing, quote, detestation or vilification of an individual or group of individuals, while legally protected speech, quote, expresses dislike or disdain or discredits, humiliates, hurts, or offends, unquote. Bill C-63 risks censoring a range of expression from journalistic reporting to healthy conversations among youth under 18 about their own sexuality and relationships. That's what the CCLA said. And the CCF said the legislation gives the Canadian Human Rights Commission the power to impose civil fines of up to $50,000 on offenders, as well as awards of up to $20,000 paid to complainants who claim online speech discriminated against them, in some cases without having to reveal their identities. So, yeah, we're unfortunately seeing this a lot in the world right now, where regardless of where you fall in the political spectrum, I think we can agree those are really vague terms that kind of seem to overlap. Yeah, so if you're Canadian, look into this thing more and maybe call your politicians.
And with that said, we're going to go into the open source news. FOSS, they are retiring the Mozilla location service. So they are saying that the accuracy has steadily declined and they have no plans to restart the Stumbler program or increase investments to MLS. And they've made the decision to retire the service. So this is pretty much just a more privacy respecting, more open source way of essentially giving you location services. And websites can utilize this as well as something like custom ROMs. It's pretty common in the custom ROM community. So you can avoid Google's location services. And then pretty much a company that they relied on contacted Mozilla and alleged that MLS infringed a number of its patents, and they reached an agreement with them to avoid litigation, and that required them to make changes to their MLS policies and made it difficult for them to invest in and expand. And they retired the Moz Stumbler program, which was attacked from that. And essentially what's going on is they are slowly retiring it. You can track the issue in the link in the sources, and you can track where that's going and what's going to change. And the source code will remain available under the Apache License 2.0, and it will be archived, the final stage, by July 31st of this year. So, yeah, that's pretty much that. Kind of bummer news. I know a lot of people utilize that on custom ROMs. So if you're on a custom ROM that utilizes Mozilla, hopefully a better option will present itself shortly.
TUDA launches post-quantum cryptography for email. We are excited to announce that with this release, we are enabling quantum-safe encryption by default for all new TUDA mail accounts. We are replacing the classic asymmetric cryptography with our quantum-safe hybrid called TUDAcrypt. It combines a post-quantum key encapsulation mechanism, Crystal's Kyber, and an elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman key exchange, X25519. Prior to releasing TUDAcrypt, your secure email client was generating an RSA key pair upon registration. With the release of TUDAcrypt, we are now generating two key pairs, one ECC key and one Kyber key used for encapsulation. So the private keys are stored encrypted on our servers with a key derived from the user's password, so they can be used on any device of the user. New accounts will, from now on, only have TUDAcrypt key pairs and no RSA key pairs. In a second step of TUDAcrypt, we are now working on a mechanism to rotate different keys used in our application. Once this feature becomes available for public release, we will start to roll out post-quantum secure encryption for all 10 million existing users as well. That is a lot of users. Good job, TUDA. We plan to have the protocol formally reviewed and verified in the near future. We are in the process of improving the protocol together with the University of Wuppertal. And in the long term, we aim to implement the full PO mail protocol to achieve perfect forward secrecy and future secrecy as additional security properties. So that's pretty cool. As one of the next steps, we will also add key verifications so that TUDAcrypt will also provide cryptographically guaranteed authentication. Yeah, that's all I got. That's exciting. Awesome job, TUDAnota. TUDA. That's a very long blog post with a lot more details if you guys want to know.
And on Team Blue / Purple, I guess? No, yeah, Team Purple, introducing the ProtonMail desktop app. So anyone can now use the new ProtonMail desktop app for Windows and Mac OS with a Linux version in beta. So almost released for all three platforms. And it is only for paid users. So if you have a free plan, you can try it for 14 days, but then you have to be paid to use this. And someone on our TechLore forum asked, why is that? And I responded saying, because they need reasons for you to be a paid user. That's it. I think that's the reason. It's a free service. So I will be using the web app. I don't like using desktop clients when I can avoid it.
The next story is real quick, but pretty awesome. KeePass XC 2.7.7 has been released, and most noticeably, it supports passkeys. So I was pretty surprised to see that. I did not expect that to roll out so quickly. There's also a few other big updates. There's an import wizard. So if you are coming from another password manager, specifically 1Password or Bitwarden, it's now very easy to import your vault into KeePass. They've simplified the unlock screen. So for example, if you don't use a YubiKey, that whole field is just not there anymore. And then a bunch of other very small fixes that you can see in the post. But yeah, exciting news for KeePass XE users or people who, for any reason, are looking to switch to KeePass XE.
Okay, and then Tor is introducing something called WebTunnel. This is part of their anti-censorship team. And WebTunnel is a new type of Tor bridge designed to assist users in heavily censored regions to connect to Tor. It's available now in the stable version of the Tor browser, and WebTunnel joined their collection of censorship circumvention tech developed and maintained by Tor. It works by wrapping the payload connection into a WebSocket-like HTTPS connection, appearing to network observers as an ordinary HTTPS WebSocket connection. So for an onlooker, without the knowledge of the hidden path, it just looks like a regular HTTP connection to a web page server, giving the impression that the user is simply browsing the web. WebTunnel can be used as an alternative to OBFS4 for most Tor browser users, and while OBFS4 and other fully encrypted traffic aim to be entirely distinct and unrecognizable, WebTunnel's approach to mimicking known and typical web traffic makes it more effective in scenarios where there's a protocol allow list and a deny by default network environment. So just one more option to get around circumvention or censorship circumvention.
That'll take us into Misfits, and our first story is, whew, it's a doozy. So the CEO of data privacy company OneRep.com founded dozens of people search firms. This comes from Brian Krebs. I'm going to quote the article. The data privacy company OneRep.com bills itself as a Virginia-based service for helping people remove their personal information from almost 200 people search websites. However, an investigation into the history of OneRep finds this company is operating out of Belarus and Cyprus, and that its founder has launched dozens of people search services over the years. So playing both sides of the field, putting your data up there and then charging you to remove it. The rest of the article is really just laying out the evidence for this claim and all the different things that Brian Krebs found. It is worth noting that Mozilla Monitor is based on OneRep. The New Oil, myself, I have emailed them for comment. And as of this recording, they have not replied. I will be removing them from my website until further notice. When I found out they were a white label, I was kind of on the fence, and I've been meaning to reach out to them and ask them, like, so if you're a white label, not to be rude, but why should people go through you instead of just going straight to the website? And before I had a chance to reach out, this popped up. So this really sucks, and if we hear anything new, we'll keep you updated, but this is definitely not looking good for Mozilla. Or OneRep, I guess.
Okay, this is interesting. So SIM swappers are hijacking phone numbers in eSIM attacks. So eSIMs are digital cards stored on the chip of the mobile device and serve the same role as normal SIM cards. And the technology has become increasingly popular among smartphone makers because eSIMs eliminate the need for a SIM card slot and can offer cellular connectivity and small wearables. So SIM swappers relied on social engineering or worked with insiders at mobile carrier services to help them port a target's number. But companies implemented more protections to thwart these takeovers. So cybercriminals turned their attention to emerging opportunities in new technologies. Now, attackers breach a user's mobile account with stolen, brute-forced, or leaked credentials and initiate porting the victim's number to another device on their own. They can do this by generating a QR code through the hijacked mobile account, then can be used that can be used to activate a new eSIM. They then scan it with their device, essentially hijacking the number. A bonus for the attackers is that by porting a number to their device, they gain access to SIM-linked accounts in various messenger apps, which opens up more opportunities for scamming other people, like posing as the victim and tricking them into sending money. To defend against eSIM swapping attacks, researchers recommended using complex and unique passwords for the cell service provider account and enabling two-factor authentication if possible. And on that note, I'm going to add my own here, which is try to utilize your phone number that's dedicated to your cell plan as little as possible. I find that to be easier to keep things a little bit safer, because even if you are SIM swapped, at least like your signal number isn't the same number for your cell plan, for example. So it's a little bit harder to do as much damage with it. Or if you're using it for SMS 2FA or something like that. But if it's a VoIP service, it's a different account. So just kind of mixing up accounts a little bit better.
Our last story is quick. Blacklight has been updated with new tracking info and caching options. So Blacklight is a tool from The Markup, who does excellent investigative reporting on privacy. Basically, you can visit their Blacklight tool, you can paste a website, and it'll tell you of any known trackers that are on that website. Keep in mind the keyword there is known trackers. There may be other stuff that they just don't know, is like they haven't tagged it as a tracker, but it'll definitely catch a lot of the common ones, Google Analytics, the Metapixel, stuff like that. So they say, quote, "We have updated the version of Tracker Radar we use, bringing you the most up-to-date information on trackers across the web." And they also go on to say, "Caching improves Blacklight's performance, but may also show out-of-date information. We have added an option to force a request, overriding Blacklight's cache and triggering a brand new scan of the page." So cool stuff, and just one more thing to keep in your little privacy toolkit.
All right, and that's going to send us out for the week. So again, your insurance rates could go up with car data collection. Apple is allowing more interesting things in the EU with a lot of caveats. Lots of great open source news overall, and more. If you like this and you want to support us a little bit better so we can keep this going for free, definitely check out our Patreon down below at patreon.com/surveillancepod. Links are down below. We're trying to make a lot of improvements to the Patreon experience to make things smoother for all of you. Aside from that, we also support LibrePay and also Monero as well if you don't like Patreon. With all that said, we just want to thank you for listening, and also another great and free way to support us is by sharing a story or just staying subscribed or just engaging in some way, shape, or form with what we're doing over here. We really appreciate that, and definitely give us a rating or like or whatever it is that you can do to give us some love. And that's all we have to say this week. So we'll see you next week for SR 172, and peace out.